there are all these engineering students out there who are working on things that could unleash something terrible on the world, but it could also be something that's wonderful for the world.
Should we be optimistic or pessimistic about the direction technology is taking us?
The technology is going to be invented no matter what. You can't stop it. I'm just optimistic that the good will win.
How do we educate the next generation of innovators to have a well-developed social conscience?
Educating engineers to be engineers only is criminal.
Don't you see the danger, John, inherent in what you're doing here? Genetic power is the most awesome force the planet's ever seen, but you wield it like a kid that's found his dad's gun.
Should technology companies be self-regulating?
If the field itself does not take some leadership, I think that's when regulation comes in a very heavy-handed way.
Our guest is Percy Strell, provost of Stanford University.
Monstrous Technologies, coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Hey, philosopher, thanks for downloading this episode of Philosophy Talk.
And thanks so much for being our partner. You've supported us in the past, and we're really grateful for that support. But we need your help now more than ever.
So here's what you do. Go to our website, philosophytalk.org, click the donate button, and help us make more of what we know you love.
Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
And thank you for donating.
Holding hands at midnight, 'neath the starry sky. Nice work if you can get it, and you can get it if you try.
Will new technologies like artificial intelligence and bioengineering be the salvation of humankind?
Or will they destroy our bodies, our democratic institutions, and even our planet?
And who is going to control the technologies of the future?
This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from Simex Auditorium on the Stanford campus.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner, where Ken teaches philosophy and I direct the Philosophy and Literature Initiative.
Welcome, everyone, to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about monstrous technologies as part of Stanford University's Frankenstein at 200 project.
Monstrous technologies? That's a strong word, Ken.
Well, Josh, come on. Look, I love my iPhone, but you got to admit, smartphones are causing an epidemic of distraction, insomnia, and depression. That seems pretty monstrous to me.
And that's just techno panic, Ken.
Techno who?
Look, people are always freaking out about the latest technological invention, you know, like the printing press, the mechanized loom, newspapers, electricity. It always turns out there was never anything to worry about.
Oh, Josh, come on. Tell that to the inhabitants of Chernobyl or Fukushima, or the victims of asbestos poisoning, or all those thalidomide babies. You're a big literary guy. It's just like Mary Shelley says in her novel Frankenstein that we're thinking about. Technology can be deadly.
Look, you've watched too many Frankenstein movies, Ken. The novel is a lot more subtle and sophisticated than you or Hollywood are making it out to be.
Yeah.
I mean, look, that novel, it's not just some Luddite screed against the horrors of technology. I mean, look, it's a philosophical investigation into personal identity. It's a brilliant experiment with literary form. It's an exploration of deeply buried antisocial impulses. I mean, that novel...
Oh, man, no, you're forgetting the main thing, Josh. It's also about a technological marvel that runs around killing people. You left that out.
All right. Fair point. But remember that great scene in the novel where the creature learns about language. He calls language a godlike science. And writing, he says, opens up a field for wonder and delight.
Oh, Josh, you're waxing so poetical. Big deal.
Well, not just a big deal. Writing is a technology, and it's among the greatest technologies ever invented. The novel celebrates that kind of technology, and we should too.
Oh, look, Josh, look. I love writing too. I mean, that's why I spend hours and hours writing myself. It's not just because I have writer's block. It's because I love writing. I even love other people's writing. I love reading your writing, Josh. But, you know, even a technology as glorious and as powerful as writing has its downside. Look, no writing, no Mein Kampf, no Mein Kampf, no World War II, QED. Technology can be busted.
Godwin's law, Ken? Look. It's not the technology of writing that was responsible for Mein Kampf. You know, it's the guy who wrote it, and it's the people who read and believed it. I mean, you can't blame technology for what people do with the technology. You have to blame the people.
But you're missing my point, Josh. Technology is often designed, explicitly designed, to exploit human weaknesses. Why do you use your iPhone so much? Because it's a drug, Josh. And so is social media. And social media is driving people to suicide, and it's ruining our democracy.
Sounds like you don't trust people very much to handle their own technology.
Why should I?
Well, okay, but what do you want? You want the government to intervene? I mean, that's paternalism. Look, if I want to waste my time watching cat videos on Facebook, that's my business.
No, Josh, it's not just your business. My life is impacted by your choices. Their lives are impacted by your choices. Facebook and its addicted, addled users, they're destroying our democracy, my democracy.
Okay, I'm not going to defend Facebook.
Well, that's good.
But the question still remains, right? How can we prevent all the negative outcomes, the monstrous outcomes, without losing all the benefits? And how can we have the good outcomes without resorting to paternalism and stifling individual freedom?
That's a good question, Josh. Good question, but I think the answer is kind of obvious. Technology producers and designers have to take on some of the responsibility. They have to do a better job of predicting, compensating for the effects of their inventions. And they have to care. They have to care about more than just creating cool, fun gadgets and, you know, making a bunch of money.
Yeah, and pigs have to fly.
Well, look, if producers refuse to regulate themselves, well, then the rest of us will just have to make them an offer they can't refuse.
What?
Don't take me wrong. I'm talking about changing the incentive structure.
Oh, okay, so taxes, regulations.
Or social kind of shaming, maybe. Yeah.
Well, look, I agree we've got to do something. If we don't do anything, nightmare scenarios may well be around the corner. I agree with you. We're going to start seeing things like on Black Mirror.
Right. That's a great TV show. But you know, how much of that show is pure fiction, and how much of it is future reality?
Well, as it happens, Ken, we asked our roving philosophical reporter, Liza Veal, to find out. She files this report.
If you've seen the show Black Mirror, you've wondered, how crazy is this stuff? Total fantasy? 50 years away? 10 years away? Dylan Hendricks works at the Institute for the Future. He takes the technology in Black Mirror very seriously.
It is something that internally within our culture, like everybody watches Black Mirror and has opinions about it.
So how do the futurists weigh in? One quick example, the show features these hyper-capable robot guard dogs. Those exist already. Hendricks bets that soon they'll be available commercially, and we'll have to decide how to regulate them. This next example is a little more complicated.
Well, it's been tested, though, right?
Of course.
She's not like a guinea pig.
Yes, it's all fully tested, perfectly safe.
In the episode Archangel, a brain implant allows a mother to monitor her child, her location, her vital signs, even her vision.
Tap this icon here to relay her optic feed.
This is what she's seeing now?
That's right.
Whoa. That's amazing.
And there are parental controls you can apply to that.
Controls?
Content limitations. If she witnesses something that causes her cortisol levels to rise, like stress, it can kind of paint out whatever's triggering it.
Hendrick says this chip has a lot of realistic elements. Smartphones can act as GPS trackers if we want them to. Even the more far-fetched elements, like the idea of viewing the world through the child's eyes, is not so crazy. We have some of the technology to capture images directly from the optical nerve, translate and broadcast them. But the core of this episode is relatable on a basic level.
The temptation of parents to know everything a child's going through at every moment is more or less kind of a realistic, even sort of present day kind of choice for parents.
As a society, we have the technology to surveil and control our children more than we ever did. So we face a question.
Are children allowed to make mistakes? Isn't that a part of growing up? And if you stop them from making mistakes, will they make bigger mistakes later?
Hendrick's last example is about virtual reality.
Exit game.
He says the highly convincing VR we see in Black Mirror, it's not that unrealistic.
We've already reached a turning point where they're very compelling, that people will want to spend more time in simulated environments.
But Hendrix is an optimist. He sees possibilities in VR. For example, he says if we can't stop humans from doing bad things to each other in real life, then maybe we can channel that antisocial behavior into virtual reality. Here's an example that might be a little hard to swallow.
If you could prove that sexual assault in the real world went down because of these kind of simulations existing, is that simulation not then kind of a public good, right? Like if it turns out we can't fully deter behavior, but we could channel it into something where it's less destructive to real people's lives.
Hendrix says this question will only become more pressing, and it doesn't just apply to VR. Does this technology have more potential to encourage impulses towards antisocial behavior or mitigate the consequences of it? Dylan Hendrix is asking these questions. So are parents. So are some technologists. But who has the final say? For Philosophy Talk, I'm Liza Veal.
Thanks, Liza, for that tour of the dystopian possibilities for the future. I'm Ken Taylor, along with my Stanford colleague, Josh Landy. We're coming to you from CMEX Auditorium on the Stanford campus as part of the university's Frankenstein at 200 project.
Our guest today is a physicist and former dean of the School of Engineering here at Stanford, who recently became the 13th university provost. Please welcome to the Philosophy Talk stage, Persis Drell.
Thank you.
So, Persis, Josh and I were talking earlier about potentially dangerous, even monstrous technologies. I know that's been a topic that you've been interested in for a while. When did you first get interested in these kind of questions?
Well, I think the right answer to that is I grew up with it. My father was a theoretical physicist who spent part of his life pursuing the dream of understanding the natural world and then spent a lot of his life pursuing attempting to preserve the world from the horrors of nuclear war as an arms controller. And so it was in the house from when I grew up.
So where did that leave you? I mean, Ken and I were arguing earlier about whether we should be optimists or pessimists. I mean, do you think that there is now or there is, you know, coming up some Victor Frankenstein type who's about to unleash something really deadly on the world? Or do you think basically we're going to be okay?
Oh, I think there are all these engineering students out there who are working on things that could unleash something terrible on the world, but it could also be something that's wonderful for the world. That's the way technology and discovery works. I'm just optimistic that the good will win.
So okay. Well, wait. So you're optimist. I mean, I want to take the world at large because we're focused. We can be focused on the American context. You know, if Hitler had won that war, if Stalin had he did prevail for a long time.
He sure did.
Visited horror upon horror.
Yeah.
Technology in the wrong hands. Some terrorist gets a dirty bomb. I mean, in total, looking at the world in total, what controls technology in the world taken in total?
People. In the end, it has to be people taking responsibility for the technology that they create. The technology is going to be invented no matter what. You can't stop it.
Can we keep germ weapons, nuclear arms, chemical weapons are all over the world. There's a cheap dictator's weapons of mass destruction. Can we keep problematic technology out of the hands of all problematic people?
We can never do it perfectly, but we've had nuclear weapons since 1945. And they haven't been used since 1945. It's a great example. We have biological weapons that we, so far, have controlled. Does that mean we can stop working at it? Absolutely no. But you have reason to be optimistic.
So you look out at the world, you look out at global warming, all this sort of stuff, you look out at the world and you like are confident and optimistic. And you don't look at it like those folks on Black Mirror.
But if I wasn't optimistic, where does that leave me?
Well, maybe vigilant. I mean, right?
So I
mean,
is there believe in being vigilant.
Right. So okay. So what about, you know, things that are on the horizon? Things like, for example, you know, video fabrication technology. I mean, it seems like, if I understand correctly, we may be on the verge of people being able to make you be saying on video anything they want you to.
And yeah.
I mean, so who's going to control that kind of?
Well, that's a really good question.
Well, then, you know what? We'll get to that. Okay. So we'll try to answer that really good question and more really good questions from our audience after this short break. This is Philosophy Talk, coming to you from Simex Auditorium on the Stanford campus. Our guest is the Provost of Stanford University, Persis Drell.
In our next segment, we're going to talk about how we can balance exciting innovation against social responsibility. How do we get the upside without the downside?
Invention, attention, and prevention, along with questions from our technologically savvy audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
Let's hear it for our musical guests, the Tiffany Austin Trio. This is Philosophy Talk. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Stanford physicist and provost Persis Drell. And we're thinking about monstrous technology.
So we're soon going to be taking questions from you folks. So if you have a question, please take a spot in front of one of these microphones at the front of the stage.
So, Persis, okay, we live in a capitalist society. I think capitalism makes it really hard to balance innovation against social responsibility. Can we do it?
Well, I would say we have existence proofs where we've done it in the past. I would say we've done it with nuclear technologies, and we've done it with some of the biological technologies like recombinant DNA, where the community has really stepped up and taken some responsibility and not just pushed technology as far as it could into commercial applications, because they recognized there were potential dangers and threats out
there.
Yeah,
yeah. I mean, you really are an optimistic person. And I'm glad you're our provost. I wouldn't want a downer for a provost. I really would. Right, I just wouldn't. But I got to say, I'm much more of a downer. I'm not sure I believe in the capacity of capitalist production of technology to always regulate technology for the human good. And here's why. Because the decisions are made kind of locally. That is, yeah. I'm going to automate and make my company more efficient. I'm going to lay off workers. I don't think about the aggregate effect of that. I think about my competitive advantage. This person competing with me, and it's not just within this economy, it's around the world if I don't do this. So the pressures are all generated bottom up locally, but then they aggregate into something, a mess, right?
And so I think we saw this in spades with Facebook, right? And Twitter. I mean, the way in which these social media, you know, their profit is driven by clicks and likes and shares. And those are driven mostly by controversial news stories. And so conspiracy theories and fake news, well, they're good for the bottom line. Yeah.
So I think what you're bringing up is a really good point, which is that with the two examples I gave, the threat was evident early.
Right.
You
right.
knew there was a really serious threat out there. I think the threats, and they are very real, and we've seen them acting out from social media, machine learning, those, we didn't realize they were dangerous.
Right.
And so now we're in a somewhat different situation. I would also say another stark difference in my view is that in the cases, again, let me use nuclear weapons or recombinant DNA, there were leaders of the field who stepped up and led. Where are the leaders?
Well, right, but that's quite, I mean, I think the threat from nuclear weapons is, you're right, it's stark. Because, you know, people used to think about limited nuclear war and all that sort of stuff, and then all these studies came out about nuclear winter, and it's like, oh my God, we can't just trust this to the Soviet Union and the Americans fighting it out. It's like the whole world is like has a stake in it, right? And I think global warming's the same way, but there's a like who goes first problem kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the Paris Accords were cool, but you know, look what our current president did. Mm-hmm. Right, I mean, but still, there's a who goes first problem, right? I could free ride off the world doing this. So I just think we don't really have mechanisms that kind of force the balancing of innovation and responsibility. I just think we have precious few mechanisms.
Well, in the case of global warming, I think capitalism will come to our aid when the economy starts to tank because of the effects. But I'd still go back to the internet and say the challenge there is, I think there is the recognition of the problem is now real, but I'm not yet quite seeing where the leadership is
right.
going to come from. If the field itself does not take some leadership, I think that's when regulation comes in a very heavy-handed way.
I mean, I
way.
Could make them an offer they can't refuse, just like I said in the opening.
Yeah, I've got to agree with you now, Ken, on this point. Because, you know, when you see what's actually coming out of Facebook now, it seems as though either they're genuinely in denial or they're in some kind of, you know...
Well, wait a minute. See, again, but there is a logic of capitalism, and we are capitalist production, and markets are cool things. I don't want to deny that markets are cool things. And I think Facebook's business model depends on something important. That they're a platform, not a publisher, right? Mm-hmm. And I think they're being a platform allows them to say, let all comers come, and we like that. We're like, oh, there's freedom, there's accessibility. If we force them to be a publisher and then take on all the liabilities and obligation that a publisher has, then I actually don't know if they survive economically.
How was that decision made?
They were
a platform and not a publisher. How did?
Because they're good capitalists, right? Because what's happening to the publishers? They're
right.
getting hammered. By this new technology, right? And if they take on the certifying and verifying and distributing and being liable and all that stuff, I don't think they get all those investors to invest in them. I don't know. There might be some of them in the audience. Would they have gotten all those investors to invest in them if they said, oh, our business model is we're going to be a publisher?
Maybe, but meanwhile, if we're relying on people within those industries to do self-regulation, it seems to me we're just putting the foxes in charge of the hen house. I'm not sure we're really going to get very far.
You're giving them competing incentives.
Right, exactly. So the incentive structure seems to be wrong. I mean, I don't know whether process. I mean, you know, I love it that you're an optimist, even about global warming. I mean, I think you're a little more of an optimist than I am. You know, maybe capitalism mm-hmm. will kick in after mm-hmm. everything. Yeah. It's too late. Mm-hmm. But anyway. But so what? You know, what do you think? I mean, is there a way that we could maybe without regulation. Maybe we could sort of change the incentive structure at least at the level of the social and make it uncool to destroy the planet for cash. You know, stuff like that.
I think on the issue of the internet, I think the threat has become visible in recent years. And I actually see evidence that the thought leaders are starting to think about how to address this. And I'm seeing a lot, for example, more discussion, not my field of expertise, but let me just put this out there, around, say, the subject of machine learning and the dangers of machine learning, than we heard, say, even 5 years ago or 10 years ago around new social media platforms. Now, that just might be that the threats of machine learning are more obvious, but I actually think it might be that the thought leaders are starting to have much more of a sense of responsibility. The culture of Silicon Valley has been, as I think was articulated in a New York Times article quite recently, build it and ask for forgiveness later. Yeah. I think we're starting to move away from that. And so I see the, again, optimist that I am, the beginnings of that development of social responsibility. We see that among our students here as well.
Right.
So
I want to ask you about the students right. in the next segment, but I want to back off to the, I want to ask about the thought leaders and, mm-hmm. and the innovators. I mean, I grew up to believe, let science and innovation go, right? You said innovate it, build it, then worry about the consequences. Because if you start out, I mean, do you believe we should ever restrain technology and science in advance, saying, don't go there, don't go there, don't go there?
I don't think that works. I think certainly at the basic discovery, scientific discovery stage, you don't know enough. Mm. And then even when you're going into the technology stage, I mean, you may discover a biological weapon. You may discover limited nuclear weapons and decide, we're not going to build limited nuclear weapons. But you know, I have to know what could be done there because somebody else, that bad guy on the other side of the field, might not have had the same moral sense of responsibility. So I have to be able to defend myself.
But since science is about the disseminate, if we're talking science,
yeah.
right, and universities, for example, and we're not talking private industry, we don't keep our discoveries secret. We disseminate them. We publish them, right? The world, I mean, I think I suspect, tell me if I'm right about this, probably every college physics student knows how to build a nuclear bomb.
No. It's actually not that easy, but...
I mean, I'm not saying they have the capacity, but they know what has to be, or they can figure out what has
to
be.
Well, they all know the basic
right.
physics.
Right.
The technology to make it, to really have...
Right, and to make it miniature and all that stuff.
And to assure criticality and so forth is not... It's hard, but I am told if you search hard enough on the internet, you can find it to make smaller nuclear weapons, so you control the fissile material.
And take the Iranians who Trump is so worried about and the world is worried about. I mean, they're smart enough.
Oh, sure.
They're technologically advanced enough that if they set their mind to it, now the question is, would we put a stop to it? But they're technologically advanced enough to do this.
Right.
You can't take this knowledge and put it in some bottle, so...
Right, so that was why so many people worked for so hard on the non-proliferation treaty, and we didn't get it, and that's where the focus now is in proliferation. It's not so much in mutual assured destruction and worry about the Soviet Union, which doesn't exist anymore.
So it sounds like there are actually, in a way, three stages here. There's the stage of invention, and I think you're making very, I agree with you, I think we can't stop that.
Right.
But then there's the stage of recognizing that it's potentially dangerous,
yes.
And maybe we should be encouraging people to do that, and then potentially down the line there are interventions that we can use, regulations or social norms.
Right, and I think it is I think that's a wonderful separation, Josh, and it's at that middle stage where it's absolutely critical for the technologists themselves to have a sense of moral and social responsibility towards what they see themselves developing.
Right.
That is the critical moment.
Right.
Because if it's later and it's regulation, it's not so good.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about monstrous technologies in front of a live audience at the Stanford campus with our guest, Chris Israel. And we've got questions from that live audience. I'll go from one side to the other room. I'll start with you. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Hi. Good evening. My name is Jayesh. I did my master's here at Stanford. My question is, you made a very good point about not being able to stifle or stop or slow down the invention phase of technology. But what about the aspect of influencing it? Because there's a lot of discussion around how, for example, all these things like Twitter, Facebook, Google were built by a select few of the world, and how that's affected the way those technologies have shaped our world. For example, Twitter is a great place where people are harassed and bullied all the time. And people have discussed about how it has implications on people's lives, both positive and negative. What are your thoughts on how we can sort of change that? How can we add more diversity in both, in terms of the people who are inventing those technologies, as well as the ideas that we use when we do that?
Got an answer?
So Twitter is, again, it's a tool that has marvelous benefits, and it is used in really negative ways. I ponder a lot, is there a way of ensuring at least some accountability in Twitter? And my understanding is that many companies they actually have rules that they don't even enforce themselves about fake accounts and so forth. So that is a place where I believe Twitter, let's pick on them, should actually force a little more accountability in the use of its platform. And along with that, it would be great for society to realize that just because speech is protected doesn't mean it's actually appropriate all the time.
Right. So what do you think about this? We all have to be into this making and remaking of the world together. And you can't. I don't want to train our students to say, hey, look, I'm an engineer. I'm a physicist.
Right? I totally agree with you, Ken.
Right. So how do we do that? How do we get this conversation to be a broad conversation involving all these people? Because it seems to me that's what we need. We need the physicist sitting with the philosopher, sitting with the politician, sitting with the journalist, right?
And the economists, let's not forget the economists,
because
they actually know what they're doing in this case.
yeah, maybe.
maybe.
But there are some models. I mean, you know, hospitals have ethics boards and are responsible for certain kinds of...
Well, aren't we responsible for there being review boards, right? Human subject, because of some experiments that took place here at Stanford?
The prison experiment?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, well. Yes, the IRB.
Yes.
Right. So it's not as though everything's the Wild West, right? So, and so we just have to throw up our hands. It seems to me that, in fact, we could decide as a society we want to shift some of these areas of technological innovation more in the direction of things that have a little bit of inbuilt policing and responsibility.
Yes, we could, and it wouldn't be that hard to do. The first thing, though, is to acknowledge the threat. And I think that's really what's just happening. So I agree with where you're going, but I would point that it probably is a little unrealistic to think it would all be in place now, because I just don't think until a few years ago we recognized the magnitude of the threat.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, ma'am. What's your comment or question? Who are you and what's your comment or question?
My name is Victoria, and I'm currently an undergraduate student on campus. So I guess my question is philosophical, perhaps, in nature. Since structurally the rise of artificial intelligence, or by extension the aspiring to develop it and research it, implies the displacement of conventional workforces, right? So the abilities of computers to start taking on complicated tasks that is beyond even monotony. So we've seen, you know, in cases where they're starting to take on diagnosing diseases or producing legal documents or, you know, even creating a poem, etc. So in that case, of course, these abilities got magnified, and, you know, those workers that are the most vulnerable in societies are harmed the most. So in that case, do you think there's a moral responsibility of companies or people who participate in AI development to compensate that in forms of taxation or others? And how do we go about kind of thinking about that conceptually?
Do you have a view, or you want to punt this one?
Well, I do, but I actually would love to hear from the philosopher first.
Well, well, I think this is a really hard question. And I think it's a
really
huge question. Because there are people, speaking of the economists, I mean, there's a disagreement about this. People used to believe that in the old days, technology destroyed jobs, but it produced compensating jobs. That's actually not as true as you might think. That's a complicated thing. But there's some people believe the day is coming when technology is just a net destroyer of the demand for human labor, and that we could see that in the next 10 or 15 years, we could see the demand for human labor decrease 40%. By the next century, we could see the demand for human labor almost go away, right? How do we live in such a world? Right. Of course there's a moral responsibility, but who does it fall on? It's a really hard, I mean, that is among the hardest questions we
Look,
face.
I'm not saying it's an easy question, but I think we can apply similar principles here to the ones we apply elsewhere and just say, look, if there is something that a reasonable person or set of people could predict, then you should be setting about trying to predict it. And if you're not even trying, then I think you can be held liable for that.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're coming to you from Simex Auditorium on the Stanford campus as part of this university's Frankenstein at 200 project.
We're thinking about monstrous technologies with Persis Drell, Stanford's new provost.
In our final segment, we'll ask Persis how she thinks we should train the engineers of the future.
Educating for responsibility, plus more questions from our audience when Philosophy Talk continues. Thanks again to our musical guests, the Tiffany Austin Trio. I'm Josh Landy, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. We're thinking about monstrous technologies with Persis Drell from Stanford University. So we've got a whole bunch of questions. So let me start with some. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, ma'am.
Hi, I'm Sarah. I'm an undergraduate here at Stanford. And we live in a world in which there are huge socioeconomic disparities, and as newer technologies become available, they're often only available to those of higher socioeconomic status. So I was wondering what y'all's opinions were on how inventors and companies can ensure that those disparities don't become so big that they're unable to be overcome.
Presupposition of her question is that it is the responsibility of the technologists themselves. Do you share that presupposition?
I would like to say I think broader society should take responsibility. I like it when technology does take responsibility too, but I would also like to point out in some ways certain technology has been incredibly democratizing. So it has cut both ways, but ultimately for me, and this probably reveals a certain amount about my political persuasions, I do believe society should be taking responsibility to ensure that it is available broadly.
You said technologies that are democratizing. Sometimes technologies that look democratizing, so the internet is supposed to be a great democratizing technology, right? sometimes technology that are democratizing just break down the public square because they substitute noise for knowledge, right? Instead of these authorized, these top, one of the things that these top-down authorities did, they certified stuff as legitimate, as knowable, as worth paying attention to. When everybody has access.
But let me give a very specific example. Theoretical physics used to be, if you want to do theoretical physics, you had to be in one of those pillars like Princeton or Stanford or Harvard or Oxford. And if you wanted to learn about the hottest, latest thing in theoretical physics, you had to write away with a little postcard for a preprint.
Okay, right, I remember
that's
those.
Gone.
Yeah, that's
and
true.
Now theoretical physics innovation comes from all across the world.
That's
it's
true.
Been phenomenal.
That's true. That's the upside, right?
I'm the optimist.
Yeah. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir. What's your comment or question?
I'm Wade from Portland, Oregon, and as an aspiring engineer in a very large organization, how do you feel one should navigate these considerations when you're just a tiny cog in maybe a much greater machine?
Yeah, there you go, Princess.
Wow.
That's for you.
Never lose your moral compass, no matter what level you are in the organization, and hold yourself accountable to it, and it will guide you.
Well, okay, so those are inspiring words. So this brings me to asking you, are these words enough to inspire the next generation of budding engineers? We've got a room, including some current students here. So what do we do to try to make sure that the next generation are going to be helping the world rather than sort of new Victor Frankensteins creating without the proper vigilance?
So I am a huge believer that engineers need to be educated not just in engineering, but they need to be educated broadly because they need to care about the impacts of the technologies that they're going to be involved in inventing. They don't get that by taking more physics classes or more math classes or more engineering classes. They get that by taking a philosophy course, or they get that by taking a literature course and being forced to think through the impacts of what they're doing. Or if they're really more directly interested, take a social science course. But I think that educating engineers to be engineers only is criminal.
I totally agree with you. I say to students, I put it starkly, and they sometimes gasp. I say, you know, Hitler had his technologists. Stalin had his technologists. It's not enough to be a technologist. If you're just a technologist, you're fit to be a tool of some broader social thing. But is that what you want? Yeah. You want to just be a tool? Yeah. Right, and students sometimes are taken aback when I say this, but I think we have become too focused on imparting into our students a narrow technocratic education, right? And partly our students want that of us because of their parents and we have this silly reputation as undeserved as get rich you and all that sort of stuff, and they think chase the brass ring and get the hot job and all that stuff. And we need to address this. And I don't think this is a small thing. I think it's a huge thing.
Okay, but there's another piece of it, which is that, so I do think we have students majoring in technical subjects, computer science, whatever, for the wrong reasons. And helping them choose the subject they want to major in for the right reasons is obviously part of our responsibility, and we could be doing it better. But I also think that, and here I'm going to speak as somebody who was I was only in the School of Engineering for 2.5 years. I'm not an engineer. I've never taken an engineering course. But what engineering did, which was really very, and is doing, which is very impressive, is they actually think a lot about not just what do they need to impart to the students, but what do the students want to learn, and how do they want to learn it?
Right.
And that focus has helped some of the majors, and CS is one of them, be incredibly attractive with really good on-ramps.
I understand that.
I think other subjects, certainly my own subject, could learn a few lessons from that.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir. What's your comment or question?
Okay, good evening. My name's Shelby, and I have engineering and business degrees from here at Stanford. And there's two points. I want to be an optimist. I am an optimist somehow or other, but logic gets in the way. And when you talk about people using technology, people being responsible, the problem that I see there is it has to be every person responsible forever. It's just out there. And, you know, That's the one thing. And then the other thing is that we have AI. Now, AI is a different monster from all the others because it can have a will of its own, philosophically, potentially. And we don't know what kind of will it might develop. So those are now, so what's the question? How can we not be pessimistic, even though
I don't? That's one for you, Francis.
But I gotta say, AI is coming like gangbusters.
Yeah.
And the day is coming when anything a human can do, some AI software will be able to do better. That's just coming.
I'll take that bet.
Yeah, I will too.
No, it's coming.
I want to see
anything a human.
I want to see someone design the software to detect irony.
Look, it's already the case. And this isn't even super intelligent AI. It's just think machine learning technique. They can already out-diagnose your average doctor, right?
Fine.
Anything that involves pattern recognition, that involves...
We do a lot of things that are beyond pattern recognition.
I know that. I'm talking about today and what's coming next. It's coming. Okay, we'll take
a
vote.
If you want to be just try Google Translate. Then you'll sleep better.
You know how Google. Well, never mind. Welcome to Philosophy Talk. The last question.
Thanks. I wanted to ask about the discussion you had about encouraging humanities education. My husband and I are both alumni here. He was a philosophy major, and I was an engineering major, and we discussed this a lot about our own children now, where he hopes they get a strong humanities education.
And you?
And I say, absolutely, like, it's good to get some, but they better major in engineering. And it comes back to, I find it's employable to get the engineering degree. And I do believe you're a better person for having a humanities education, but then what happens after they get out of college? They need to pay for their rent. They need to... you know, do all these things. So, I mean, how do we close the gap there?
So, you know, I take it that Persis wasn't necessarily recommending that people major in a humanities subject.
No.
Right? But, right?
So
the thought could just be, look, if you're going to be an engineer, you know, also learn some other things. So I think there's a good compromise.
Well, but I think if I were to lay my bet on the table of the degree of the future, it is not the pure engineering degree. It's going to be a social science degree with computational literacy because you need to know the questions to ask. And there are these huge societal challenges, and I do believe the social sciences helps you understand what questions to ask, but you can't understand them without computational literacy. So I really think that's the magic combination that I would put my money on.
So if you really want your kids to get a job.
I want to address this. I want to address this briefly. Look, we are educating the makers of the world, the remakers of the world. Human society is constantly making and remaking itself. And these Stanford students that we educate, they're going to play a role in making and remaking the world. And we need to educate them in multiple things. Yes. We need to turn out excellent students. We need to turn out the great engineers, great scientists, great artists, great literary thinkers, great philosophers, great social scientists. But we also need them each to understand that making and remaking the world is a deeply collaborative thing that requires multiple disciplinary talent. There is no competition. We have this stupid thing at Stanford. The students say, you're a techie or a fuzzy. You better be both.
Right.
You better be a too fuzzy or techie or whatever that is. Because if we don't produce people in whom all these things live simultaneously, the making and remaking of the world will be a disaster. So, Persis, you got one last bit of wisdom for us?
I think we have to hold on to our optimism despite the challenges ahead.
Well, on that optimistic note, I'm going to thank you for joining us. It's been a great conversation.
Thank you.
Our guest has been Persis Drell, former dean of the Stanford School of Engineering and recently appointed as our university's 13th provost. Now, this conversation continues at Philosopher's Corner at our online community of thinkers, where our motto is cogito ergo blogo, I think, therefore I blog. And you can become a partner in that community. just by visiting our website, philosophytalk.org.
And if you have a question that wasn't addressed in today's show, either here or on the radio, we'd love to hear from you. Email your question to us at comments@philosophytalk.org, and we may feature it on our blog. Now let's hear from a man of monstrously rapid speech. It's Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, at the time Mary Shelley created Frankenstein, on a bar bet, kind of, Galvani had just made a dead frog's leg twitch with electricity, allegedly, and grave robbers were digging up bodies for medical students to use in their anatomy classes, all of which kind of provided the juice, as it were, for her novel. One of the reasons body snatching was so reviled was the widespread Christian belief that, come Judgment Day, we would be resurrected whole. Cutting up bodies might make such a resurrection a little more problematic. I don't know what the view was on amputees or guillotine victims, though headless ghosts, again, you might recall, were a bit of a literary trope for a long while there. Also, about 10 years after the writing of Frankenstein, two enterprising grave robbers named Burke and Hare took anatomy research a step further by murdering people to provide cadavers for anatomy lectures. 16 in all, it is believed, their unique method of strangulation became known as Burking, just as Galvani's name wound up describing frog leg twitching. And the name of Frankenstein came to be known as the monster, not the creator of the monster. What's up with that? The whims of legend often trump the facts of history, as we all know. The recent passing of the Reverend Billy Graham is certainly proof of that. I recall his being regarded as a somewhat relatively liberal figure in the evangelical world, certainly ecumenical, dining with popes and talk show hosts and presidents, a preacher who eschewed fire and brimstone, had a nice haircut, wore tailored suits, and did not sweat or storm about. But when he died, my, there was a torrent of ill-wishers, glad he was dead because of anti-Semitism, and he had lunch with Kissinger. Same guy, but now he's a monster. We have seen the reputations of Darwin, Freud, and Marx go up and down, with Darwin and Marx sometimes achieving monstrousness along with misapprehension, and Freud achieving more and more irrelevance as drugs replace therapy, and psychotherapists wander the streets carrying their sad little signs, "We'll reveal your unconscious processes for food." The monsters of tomorrow are being stitched together today with gene splicing, artificial intelligence applications, autonomous cars, global warming fears, and the tyranny of the algorithm. These could be real monsters or just topics for the blockbusters of tomorrow, like cloning dinosaurs, for instance. It has proven to be not so much a threat to humanity as a never-ending money machine, without once achieving reality. As for the Frankenstein monster himself, vivisection does not hold the appeal it once did, though artificial limbs abound, along with hearing aids, eyeglasses, mood-enhancing drugs, endurance-enhancing drugs, strength-enhancing drugs that can serve to make any of us an ugly psychotic monster with preternatural abilities. No Frankenstein creator needed. Right off the shelf, eliminate the middleman. Also, with advanced post-Freudian counseling techniques, we can embrace our new selves, the stray limbs we acquired legally, assimilated into a new post-human whole. And should we choose to run amok, under medical supervision, of course, and then escape to the Arctic, global warming will assure that we are not fleeing from pursuers, leaping from ice floe to ice floe, but relaxing on the newly warm and placid sea, on a flotation device, catching up with the latest fake news on our smartphone, and rubbing sunscreen on our brand new legs. A little R&R and then back to D.C. to lobby for the transhuman movement. Hacked Lives Matter. Won't you please give? I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW, Local Public Radio San Francisco, and the trustees of Leland Jr. Stanford University, copyright 2018.
Our executive producers are David Demarest and Matt Martin. Special thanks to the Stanford School of Engineering, the Symbolic Systems Program, the Department of Philosophy, and the Medicine and the Muse Program.
Thanks also to Sun Lee, Emily King, Dan Brandon, Carola Kreitmeier, Conchita Perales, and our musical guest, Adam Shulman on piano, David Yule on the bass, and the one and only Tiffany Austin on vocals.
The senior producer of Philosophy Talk is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research, and our marketing director is Cindy Prince-Bound.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups here at Stanford University and the partners in our online community of thinkers.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you too can become a partner in our community of thinkers. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
And that's a wrap.
you can get it, and if you get it,